Sam Two Wolves watched with amusement as a coney, one of the little short-eared rabbits that live in the rocks of the high country, made a meal from a sprig of grass. The fat little thing looked like it hadn't a care in the world. But of course, it did. It had to be constantly vigilant against hawks and owls, bobcats and coyotes, snakes and who knows what else down here in this distant and foreign land. And constant vigilance can be a difficult thing to maintain. That was a lesson Sam reminded himself of often. He had to. He had been lying here atop a slab of dark basalt for most of the morning, watching an empty mine site about 200 feet below. Case Wilhelm and half a dozen of his men were there. Sam had seen them earlier, but they were inside one of the several flimsy buildings left behind when the mine was last abandoned. Sam easily recognized several of the guards from his own confinement. That made him itch to pick up his rifle. This was not about him, though. He and Matt were here to help Pete and his wife, or his widow. Sam's face, already impassive, turned to granite at that thought. Whether the woman was a widow or not was something that needed to be determined. Then Sam and Matt could work out what needed to be done from there. If the truth be known, however, Sam's hope was that they would find a time and a way when he could face Case Wilhelm, just the two of them, with no chains to prevent Sam from taking Wilhelm's throat in his hands and... Sam's attention suddenly took sharp focus. Something... He squeezed his eyes shut for a brief moment to clear them, then brought his attention to a jumble of sharp rocks below his position on the mountainside. Something had moved there. He was sure of it. Well, almost sure. Something other than the coney. It was gone now, vanished into its burrow with a flick of its tailless rump. Something other than the family of young pygmy rattlesnakes that lived in the hollow 30 feet or so farther down the mountainside. That hollow would have been a better position to watch from, hidden from the sides as well as from down on the shelf where the ancient mine was, but the presence of those deadly little snakes kept Sam up here out of harm's way. He did not see the deadly little rattlers now, but there was a patch of color where before there had been none. Once he realized that, Sam was able to make the leap of recognition so sudden and clear that it was startling to realize he hadn't seen it before. It was as if a still-life painting had been hanging before him but covered with a veil, and now the veil fell away. Color, texture, form, all were there. Combined, they added up to a recognizable figure that, once seen, made him amazed that he hadn't seen it earlier. A human form. Clothed in drab colors, dark flesh and black hair, wearing a dark cap that Sam almost but not quite recognized, and then did. It was a U.S. infantryman's kepi, with the shiny black visor cut or torn off and the brass medallions removed. Sam could not get a good look at the owner of the cap, except to see that he was small, perhaps a half-grown child, an Apache, more than likely, judging by the clothes he wore. And by the hours upon hours of stoic immobility that had kept him unnoticed even by Sam's wary eyes. Like a puzzle in the Sunday rotogravure, once it was seen, it was difficult to remember why and how the picture had not been obvious to begin with. After all, he was lying there in plain sight. It occurred to Sam that if anyone were watching from farther up the mountainside, he himself would likely be just as invisible until or unless he moved. Obviously, this observer was watching the same scene that Sam was. But for what reason? That was a question. A mine guard down below provided the answer. One of the guards, not one Sam recognized, came into view when he stepped around to the side of the building where Wilhelm and the others were. The man unbuttoned his fly and proceeded to relieve himself against the sun-dried wood of the old mine shack. Sam's attention was drawn much closer when the person lying in the rocks just below him quickly moved, reaching into a spot Sam could not see from his hiding place and lifting out a rifle. The weapon looked almost but not quite familiar, and it took Sam a moment to recognize it. It was a musket, a muzzle-loading rifle of the sort that had been used in the war between the states back in the white men's country. This old rifle looked like it had seen both use and abuse in the years since it was new. That did not prevent the person below from resting the barrel on a slab of rock and taking careful aim on the mine guard down below. Sam did not particularly want a gunshot to bring the guard swarming out and starting a search of the mountainside. But if it happened, he just might be forced to shoot Case Wilhelm. From a distance like this was not the way Sam hoped to face the man, but of course he would if need be. That was up to a power much greater than he. Sam lay where he was, watching and waiting. Wondering, too. Wondering why there was no burst of smoke and boom of large caliber gunshot. The guard buttoned his trousers and ambled back around to the front of the building and out of the line of sight from the mountainside. Sam's attention shifted to the small figure with the rifle. He understood when he saw the figure move. The would-be shooter rolled over, clutching his wrist. A short, ugly pygmy rattler clung there, its fangs buried in flesh. The rattler fell away and disappeared into a crack in the rock. And Sam got his second surprise. The would-be shooter was a girl, a young woman probably out of her teens, a rather pretty young woman at that. Sam could see that she was angry now. He could not be sure, but she seemed less concerned with the potentially deadly snake bite than she was with the fact that her intended victim had gotten away. She lifted the ancient rifle and sighted down the barrel. For a moment, Sam thought she was going to shoot blindly into the roof or back wall of the mine shack in the blind hope of striking someone or something inside. Instead, she only grimaced and carefully let the hammer of the old gun down to half-cock. Then she peered closely at her wrist. Her flesh took on something of a clammy pallor under the dark copper of her skin, and she glanced with obvious regret at the tableau below her on the mountainside. After a moment, she picked up her antique Springfield and began very slowly and carefully making her way uphill. If she continued on this path, her course would take her right over top of Sam August Webster Two Wolves. Matt knew he was in trouble the moment he walked into the general store. All movement came to a halt. The customers in the place, mostly women but a few men as well, stood as still and as silent as statues, stood peering across the dark and musty room toward this intruder from across the border. And it was not that they were unaccustomed to seeing Americans. More than half of these customers were Americans themselves. Besides, no one acted that way a few days earlier when Matt came in asking if anyone knew where his brother was. Everyone then had been smiling and pleasant. Now they looked like they expected a gunfight to break out at any moment. And very likely, they did. The proprietor gave Matt a stricken look, as if he wished he'd had sense enough to hang a clothes sign in the window 2 minutes earlier. It was too late for that now, though. Matt gave a nod and a polite tip of his hat to a clutch of Mexican women standing by the yard goods, and another to a pair of white ladies whose gossip had been interrupted by Matt's arrival.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
What can I...
I'll be needing some supplies for travel. You know, the usual thing, dry staples, maybe a few cans of cherries or peaches, jerked meat, not fresh. Some coffee already roasted and ground. Don't forget a few cans of milk and some sugar, if you please.
Yes, sir. Right away, sir.
Oh, you needn't rush on my account. All these folks were here ahead of me. I don't mind waiting my turn.
No. They're just visiting.
The proprietor licked his lips and gave a tug to his shirt collar.
I have time to wait on you right now.
Whatever you think.
It'll only be a minute.
Take your time.
Matt ambled across the room to admire some ready-made shirts that were piled on a shelf. He checked the sizes by holding them up against his own torso, then with a half-hidden grin chose the three most garish and gaudy among them for Sam. One, a truly awful concoction of green and orange and blue, was so magnificently hideous that he had to have it for his blood brother. He had to wonder, though, just how shirts like these had come to be here, and how long they had been on the shelf. Surely the drummer who sold them to the owner of this store must be a legend among traveling salesmen. Matt got those and some jeans that would fit Sam and some socks as well, the socks being for himself, and a couple extra pairs in case Sam needed some, too. By the time Matt was done picking out the clothing he wanted, the shopkeeper had his food order put together and waiting on the counter, already packed in sturdy jute bags suitable for travel. Wishful thinking, perhaps. Matt looked at the bags and realized that between the food and the clothing, there would be more than one armload. And Doc Tippett's livery was down at the edge of town.
I'll be back in a few minutes with a mule to load this onto, but I can pay you for it now if you like.
Oh, well, no, whatever you wish. Anything at all. Just take it on credit if you want.
Matt gave the man a questioning glance. This storekeeper did not know Matt from Adam's off-ox. Obviously, he was more interested in getting Matt out of his store and himself out of the line of fire, if there should be any, than in being paid for his wares.
Now I'll be fine.
Matt pulled some coins out of his pocket. Matt encountered no trouble, and practically no human beings, on his way down to the livery. Matt told himself the streets of San Iba were empty because it was siesta time. Except it was still early for siesta, and the American residents of the town were unlikely to observe that delightful Mexican habit to begin with.
Quiet.
Matt snapped tight the cinches on the bay and took up the lead rope of the little mule.
Whatever will happen, it won't be in town. I saw Lieutenant Espinosa and his soldier boys riding out toward the east.
And Gerald Williams' gunfighters? What about them?
Funny you should ask. I noticed them heading west a little while ago.
West was the direction Matt needed to go in order to return to the mine and to Sam. He grinned.
Thanks, Doc. I owe you.
Yeah, you do. 25 cents for greening your horse, and $1 rental for the mule.
Matt felt good as he led horse and mule up the street to fetch his supplies and build the pack. He felt loose. Not eager exactly, but certainly ready if, when, Gerald Williams' gunman chose to turn the wolf loose. The girl's attention was focused on the mine buildings below and on the wrist where the snake bit her. She was obviously very frightened. She slipped around the slab of stone where Sam was hiding and dropped to the ground behind it, without ever turning her head to see where she was going. She crouched there out of sight from anyone below, but within 4 or 5 inches of touching Sam. The girl held the musket in her left hand. It was the right where the snake had struck her. Sam wanted to help her, intended to help. The problem was managing to do so without startling her into a scream or gunshot or some other signal that might be heard down at the mine. The mountainside where they now were afforded countless opportunities for hidden observation, but almighty few escape routes should a group of armed and angry men become aware that there were people up here spying on them. Sam felt he had little choice about how to announce his presence. He reached over and clapped one hand over her mouth and pulled, rolling her across his chest so that his arms were wrapped tight around her slim form. The result was an explosion of fury. Enough sound got out to let Sam know in no uncertain terms just how angry she was, but not so much that it would be heard down at the mine. At least he hoped not. He also hoped her struggles were not for the purpose of securing a knife so she could stab him and get away. He had not seen any weapon other than the old musket. That did not mean she had none, only that he had not specifically seen any. Sam held her arms tight to her sides, and eventually she seemed to realize that she had neither the strength nor the leverage to overcome his hold. She quit squirming and went to the other extreme, going limp in his grasp. Much better, Sam thought. Now to try to explain. But in what language? He did not even know what tribe this girl belonged to. Her mode of dress suggested she might be Apache, but for all Sam knew, she could as easily be Yaqui or Pima, or for that matter, could belong to some tribe he'd never heard of. The girl seemed to be having trouble breathing, so Sam slightly relaxed the hand that covered her mouth. He shook his head.
I sure wish I knew how to talk to you.
The girl stiffened again, then twisted her head a little so she could peer up at him out of the corner of her eye. She lay trapped within his grasp for a little while, then again relaxed.
You speak English?
Yes, of course.
Let go of me. Do not be afraid. I will not hurt you.
You would harm me, you say?
If I had to, yes.
How?
I would find a way. Just as I will find a way to make those white men suffer.
Why would you do that, little sister?
Sam relaxed his grip on the girl and backed away from her. But he kept a very close eye on her hands, lest she grab up the old rifle or pull a knife from somewhere on her person. Not, actually, that there was very much of her person that he had not already been in close contact with when he'd had his arms wrapped so tight around her.
They took my husband for a slave. He did nothing to harm them. He went to their town. He tried to buy medicine for our baby. They took him and made of him a slave.
You have a baby?
The girl seemed much too young to have a child. But then perhaps the customs of her tribe were very different from what Sam was used to.
I have a child no longer. The baby of my husband is dead. She did not have the medicine that he tried to buy in their town. She died. I must tell my husband, and I must make the man pay who caused her death.
I am sorry to hear of your loss, little sister. May I ask the name of your husband?
You would not know him. You are not of our people.
And your people would be?
The white men call us Apache.
I am of the Cheyenne. We have heard of the bravery of the Apache.
They had heard other things about the Apache, too, but he did not think this would be the best time or place to go into that. Besides, the Apaches with whom he was imprisoned had helped him when he was in need. He was in their debt.
Your husband, may I know his name?
He is called by the name Coronado. He is a warrior and a good husband. Now he wears the chains of the white men, but someday he will come home to me.
I know your husband. He is indeed a good man. Do you not know that he is free now? He and the others escaped from this place.
This is true?
Indeed. Your husband was good to me when I was sick and wore the chains of those white men. I owe him a great debt. May I make a very small payment against that debt by helping his wife now that she is in need?
How do you mean?
Let me take you back to our camp, the camp of my brother and myself. The poison of that snake has been in you too long already. I will take out as much as I can, but you are sure to be sick for a time and very weak. Let us take care of you while you are in need.
Sam slid his knife out of its sheath and offered it to the girl.
You can make the cuts yourself if you do not trust me to do it.
She looked at the sharp blade and then into Sam's eyes. Then she took a deep breath and squeezed her eyes tight shut.
Help me. Help me, please.
Matt's attention was focused on his horse much more than on his surroundings, but it was the mule that tipped him off. The little fellow's long, furry ears waggled and pointed toward the hillside above the wagon road and then flopped back flat against his head. Whatever the mule saw up there, it definitely did not like. Of course, it might just be a catamount lurking up there, but Matt doubted that. More likely the predator, or predators, he did not know how many to expect, was of the two-legged kind. He rode straight on for a moment more while he quickly assessed the surroundings. The road here passed through a scattering of young, quaking aspen, then below a rocky overhang. Matt was betting that the ambush was set up on top of that overhang. Probably they intended to take him from behind when he passed beyond it. From the top of that rock formation, anyone passing below would be a fish in a barrel. They couldn't miss. Well, unless he didn't ride blindly beneath them. And if Matt and the mule were wrong about this, no harm would be done other than the loss of a little time. Better to prepare for a dozen attacks that fail to materialize than to ignore one warning of the real thing. He waited until he was at least partially screened from that direction by a clump of pale aspen, then angled sharply off the wagon road and slipped silently to the ground. Tying his horse and the mule to a tree, Matt slid his Winchester out of its scabbard and checked to make sure there was a cartridge in the chamber, then rolled the hammer back to safecock. He also took a moment to scratch the hollow beneath the mule's jaw and give it a pat on the neck by way of a thank you.
Wait here, boys.
Matt hefted the carbine and started up the slope. He wanted to pick a route well up the hillside so he could come down on top of that rocky outcrop ahead, giving him the advantage if someone just happened to be there. Up there, taking the sunshine, perhaps. Or praying. Yeah, right. From his vantage point on the top of the bluff, Matt counted five gunmen. He was flattered that they felt he deserved such a large honor guard, but then the fellow who was in charge had seen him shoot before. This was the other of the pair of run-down American gunmen who had been with the man named Curly when he braced Matt in the saloon a few days earlier. Someone had spoken to this one, called him Lawrence, if Matt remembered correctly. Lawrence's companions this afternoon were Mexicans, but they looked like rough customers who would know which end of the gun the bullets came out of. All five were arrayed along the top of a sheer bluff that overhung the road to the old mine. All five lay belly down. They looked bored. Two of them had squirmed close together, so they were lying side by side and were, incredibly enough, smoking. Either they did not know that smoke from those dark little cigarillos would give them away, or quite possibly they simply did not care. The two lay there with their heads close together, whispering like a pair of schoolboys hiding a prank from the teacher. For their ambush, Lawrence and his men had chosen a broad, shallow shelf some 40 or 50 feet over the road. Anyone traveling on the road would have to pass directly underneath them. The drawback to their position was that in order to leave this shelf, they now would have to climb up the hillside to more or less level ground. There was no way down, and the only way up was exposed to fire from above, from where Matt now was. That was to Matt's advantage. On the plus side for the ambushers was the sheer weight of numbers. Five rifles shooting from below could create havoc. Splinters of jagged rock chips and splatters of hot lead could cut a man to pieces. Better if Matt did not let this dance begin. He placed his Winchester down very carefully so as to avoid making any noise, then cupped his hands in front of his mouth to diffuse the sound.
You! Down there!
All five of them stiffened at the sound of a voice from above and behind.
Hold still! Completely still!
Matt heard some murmuring. Quite possibly someone translating his English for the others, he suspected. That was all right. He wanted each of them to know what was being said. He would like to get out of this without any gunfire if he possibly could.
Do not turn around. Do what I say, exactly what I say, and you will live to see another day. Try to bring your guns around and you will die. You on the left, on the side towards San Iba. Slowly pick up your rifle by the barrel with your left hand. Now toss it out in front of you. Just pitch it right out there.
Tíralo al frente.
Gracias.
That was one ruined Winchester. Ruined, or at the very least, in bad need of a gunsmith.
Now your pistols.
Sus pistolas.
Including the one you're lying on. Toss it, please.
También lo que tienes, ahí debajo.
Gracias.
Matt repeated the same process with each man in turn until only the man in the middle was left. He was the American gunman called Lawrence, and he did not look happy.
Who are you? Where are you?
You know damn good and well who I am, and never mind where I am at the moment. Just do what I say and you'll live to see the sun come up tomorrow.
You're a coward. Show yourself and face me like a man.
Face three of you, do you mean? I'm not quite that dumb. Now toss that rifle like I told you.
And if I don't?
If you don't, you will not live to taste one more drink or kiss one more senorita. You saw me when your friend Curly tried to take me. Are you any faster, or do you shoot any straighter than he did? You're out of time, Lawrence. Make a play or throw that rifle down.
This is no fair fight.
You're absolutely right it isn't. Now do whatever you choose, or just lie there and let me shoot you. I suppose that could be considered a choice.
There was no way Matt Bodine would shoot a man who presented no threat to him. But he doubted Lawrence would even understand such a reluctance. He certainly would have none if their positions were reversed and he was the one up on the hillside looking down with a gun in his hands. Matt eased the hammer of his Winchester down silently, then held it out away from his body a few inches and very deliberately cocked it again so Lawrence could hear the sound of the action working.
Don't shoot!
Lawrence was scowling when he pitched his own rifle into the void. But pitch it he did.
See? That was easy enough, wasn't it? And no one got hurt. Not you, not me. I'd call that a pretty fair deal all the way around. Now, if you gentlemen will excuse me, I have places to go and people to see.
Matt stood, touched the brim of his Stetson, and began the short climb to the ridgeline that would take him back down to where his horse and mule were tied. Somewhere not far ahead, he knew, he would find the place where Lawrence and these men had left their horses. It probably would be a good idea if he were to gather them up and take them along with him. He could turn them loose, and eventually they would find their way home. Matt was smiling when he thought of how tired those boys' feet would be when they got there. Yes, sir. Very likely the general store would have a run on the sale of Epsom salts that night. He sobered. Very likely there would be a run on firearms, too. Still, he'd done everything he could to avoid bloodshed. If anyone wanted to push things beyond this, it would be on his own head, not Matt's. All of a sudden, Matt was anxious to get back to camp and meet Sam there. When he reached the point where he should turn off the road and begin climbing into the mountains in order to reach Sam and their camp, Matt stopped for a few moments and thought. He was leading the horses the five ambushers had ridden, and they presented something of a problem. If he turned them loose, they would inevitably find their way back to their respective homes. That was certain. It was also what he wanted. The thing that worried him, though, was that the horses, herd creatures to the core, might very well follow him to the place where he and Sam had their camp before they wandered away and headed back to wherever their usual homes were. And once a horse has been to a place, it can easily and unerringly go back to it. The vaquero, who was wise to the ways of the horse, could very well rely upon that trait in order to find Matt and Sam. A second attempted ambush might very well be more successful than the first had been. That was a risk the brothers would be willing to accept if and only if there was no other reasonable option. After a few moments of thinking about this, Matt grinned. He dismounted long enough to lead the mule off the road and tie it. Not only was there no need to take it with him, it could become a liability if he did. He did not know how fast the little mule could run, and there was a distinct possibility that he would be in a rather large hurry after he got rid of the spare horses. Leaving the mule hidden, he stepped back into his saddle and took up the lead rope. A half hour later, he rode straight into the mine where Sam and his Indian companions had been imprisoned in chains. There was no guard posted along the road, only the signs warning visitors away. It was almost dark by then, the dusk lying heavy over the mountainside. Matt could not make out the Branville homestead from here, but he thought he knew where it would be. He peered in that direction for a moment, his heart heavy with the thought that Anita's world and that of her children, both the boy and the as-yet-unborn child, would be shattered by the developments they found here. Still, one needs to know the truth before one can come to terms with it. If Pete was dead, it was better for her and the children that she know. Sam was right. They needed to find out. Matt rode bold as brass into the yard outside the handful of old mine buildings. Yellow lamplight streamed out of the windows of the largest building, and there was the enticing aroma of wood smoke and frying bacon in the air. Before he could reach the corral where a pair of heavy draft horses picked at hay in a small bunk, a door opened, and light spilled into the yard. A large man with a bamboo cane in his hands peered out.
¿Quién es? Who's there?
Matt drew rein and raised his hand to touch the brim of his Stetson.
Evening, neighbor.
The big man stepped out into the yard. He was a tough-looking customer, Matt thought. Likely he was the one Sam had told him about. What was the name again? Oh, yes, Wilhelm, that was it. Case Wilhelm.
Who are you, and what do you want here?
Neighbor, I'm just a delivery boy, or so you might say. Fella down the road stopped me and asked, since I was going in this direction, would I fetch these horses along with me. Said I was to leave them here.
I'm not expecting any horses.
It's no business of mine. I can just turn them loose if you like.
Did this man say who he was, or what the horses were for?
No, he didn't.
Seems strange to me that someone would have 5 spare horses, all of them saddled and bridled, but no riders for them.
Yes, sir, I expect I'd agree with you. I wonder about it, too, but it's no business of mine, and since I was heading this way anyhow, figured I could as easy do the man a favor. I meant no offense to you, though, and trust I've given none.
No, of course not. Here, let me open the gate to the pen there. We'll put the horses in there with the others. You're welcome to put your animal in, too. You can take a meal with us and spend the night if you like. If you're a hand with that gun on your hip, you might even find work here.
I thank you for the offer of both the provender and the job, neighbor, but I'm bent on doing me some prospecting up in these hills. I got the fever upon me, you might say. And truth to tell, coming across your operation here is a heap of encouragement to me. Knowing you can make a living here from whatever it is you're mining, and understand, please, that I'm not asking questions, no sir, but knowing you have a going mine, why, that encourages me no end, sir. Makes me awful glad that I happen to come this way. Now, the one favor I might ask of you in return for fetching in these horses would be for you to tell me, please, does the road run on past here, or have I come to the end of it?
There's no road past this point.
Well, then I'll thank you for that information, sir, and ride back a little way. I saw a path a few miles back that I think will get me up onto the mountain so I can do some looking around.
Would you do me a favor?
If I can, sure thing.
This outfit hires prisoners to perform some of the labor, and some of them have escaped. If you see any raggedy-ass Indians lurking around, would you bring them in, please?
Oh, I don't know if I could do such a thing as that. I don't have any authority to arrest anybody, you understand, and it isn't the sort of thing... But I could come tell you if I see any. Would that help?
Yeah. Yeah, mister. That would help a lot. In fact, I'd pay a reward to you for information like that.
Oh, I don't know as I'd want a reward, but I'd appreciate a little grub, maybe.
Look, are you sure you won't come in and eat with us? You'd be welcome.
Thank you, but I get uncomfortable with a lot of folks around. I'm what you might call shy.
Fine, but keep your eyes open for escaped prisoners while you're searching for mineral. I'd appreciate it.
I'll do that, friend.
Wilhelm stepped near and extended a hand up to Matt, who was still in his saddle.
Wilhelm. Case Wilhelm. And your name would be...
Tam. Tam O'Shanner.
Wilhelm stepped back and frowned.
It seems I've heard that name before, though I can't recall where.
Matt was about to choke to keep himself from bursting out in guffaws. Tam O'Shanner, indeed.
Oh, you might have heard of Mr. Wilhelm. I have cousins who go by the same name.
Yes? Well, I'm sure we've not met before. I would remember if we had.
Well, so would I. But I expect we might meet again sometime.
Come by any time, Tam. Any time.
Matt touched the brim of his Stetson and politely backed the bay a few steps before he wheeled it around and headed down the road at a lope. Sam listened closely and frowned. Someone was coming. 2 horses. He could think of no one Matt would bring here to their camp, so it could be that the horses belonged to someone from the prison mine down below. As a precaution, Sam tugged the blanket higher over the sleeping Apache girl and slipped into the darkness away from the fire, Winchester in hand. A few minutes later, he was able to relax. The sounds were made by Matt's horse and by a pack animal trailing behind it. On a whim, Sam remained in the shadows while Matt dismounted and tied both animals to the picket rope where Sam's horse was. Matt removed the panniers from the back of the little pack mule and unsaddled his bay, then gave horse and mule a quick rubdown. While he worked with the curry comb, Matt spoke to the form lying beside the tiny fire.
He could get up and give me a hand here, you know. Don't think a couple days in prison gives you an excuse to laze about while I wait on you. Keep this up and I'll make you go get your own food. I'll be eating bacon and biscuits. You can scrounge up some nuts and berries, or grass maybe. Do you fancy a bowl of grass stems, or do you like the buds better? Just don't expect to reap the rewards if I have to do all the work for you. Say, now, you aren't coming down sick or something like that, are you?
You want me to mix you up one of my mama's poultices or a tonic, maybe? You all right, Sam? Dagnabbit, don't just lay there. Talk to me.
Matt set the curry comb aside and strode to the mound of blankets by the fire. He obviously saw the spill of raven hair peeping out at the top, but not the person that the hair belonged to. Sam came forward then, moving silent as a ghost, just behind Matt. Matt leaned down and pulled the blanket back, exposing the face and shoulders not of his brother, but of a young woman he'd never seen before. Sam leaned practically into Matt's ear.
Whoa!
That brought the girl out of her slumber. She sprang to her knees, fear in her eyes, but determination in the set of her jaw. And a wicked little knife clutched in her fist.
Whoa, whoa! Wait a minute! Everybody calm down, I'm sorry, really!
What?
Sam took Matt by the elbow and pulled him away, then knelt beside the girl and placed a hand very lightly on her wrist to push the knife down.
Matt, this is Willow Bud's pail in springtime, but you can call her Willow. Willow, this is my brother Matt, the one I was telling you about. I'm sorry if my little joke went awry.
The girl sat up and tugged at her clothes to smooth and straighten everything. Somehow, in the process of her doing that, the little knife disappeared.
No, don't get up. I want you to stay down, please, and pull the blanket up high. You need to stay warm. Matt, could you bring anything we can use to make a good rich broth or soup? Willow was struck by a snake this afternoon, a rattler. I know some of the venom got into her bloodstream, for I wasn't able to get to it quickly. She hasn't been eating much lately, so she needs nourishment more than anything else, and she needs to lie quiet.
Cold sweat beaded on Willow's upper lip and across her forehead. Sam used his bandana to mop it away, then tucked the blanket tight around her shoulders and high under her chin.
We have tinned milk and dried beef. That and some saleratus and flour will make a nice thick gravy to put over some of your biscuits.
Matt smiled at the pretty girl.
Grub like that would make anybody feel perky.
Before you go making even more of a fool of yourself than you usually do, brother, you might want to know that Willow's husband is a friend of mine. We were both in chains down there, he and I. He befriended and helped me.
Matt gave the girl a sheepish little boy look.
She... I'm sorry, miss. Ma'am. I mean, sorry.
Lie quiet, Willow. We'll have a proper meal for you shortly.
Sam and Matt turned to the mundane and long familiar chores of putting a campfire meal together, something they had been doing for almost as long as either could remember. Soon they had a fresh pot of coffee boiling, while a pan of biscuits browned and, in a can that was pressed into service as a pot, Sam's chipped beef concoction bubbled. Willow was able to eat very little, and soon she was asleep, her frail body striving to fight off the effects of the poison from the snake bite. The brothers tended to her first, then when she was asleep, filled plates for themselves and carried them a short distance away from the fire, both to keep out of the light in case some of Gerald Williams' men should happen on them, and to avoid disturbing the sleeping girl.
Now, tell me about your day. Then I will fill you in on mine.
The Blood Brothers fell quickly into a pattern. Sleeping during the day, at night they crept down to the mine where Matt kept watch with his rifle at hand in case Sam should be discovered. Sam, meanwhile, slipped cautiously down onto the loose tailings slope where the crushed ore from the mine was discarded. Working silently lest his presence be betrayed to the men above, Sam dug through the tailings in search of Peter Branville's body.
The really unpleasant thing is that not finding anything proves nothing. Am I not finding Pete because his body is not there? Or am I simply not finding him yet? Under these circumstances, I hate to admit it, but my professors back in school were correct. It is just awful hard to prove a negative. In a situation like this, a negative offers neither comfort nor proof.
Do you think we should quit?
No, not yet. I'm beginning to get a feel for the way the discarded ore is distributed, and I hate to tell you this, but I am unfortunately finding something. Just not... well, not what we are looking for.
Bodies?
Yes. Two who appear to have been prisoners, either Apache or Yaqui, and one middle-aged Mexican. I also found... Matt, I can't even decide if this last one was human remains or bones tossed down with kitchen leavings.
Look, maybe it would help to take a night off and just sleep, or I can dig.
No. It would make such a racket that the men of the mine would be sure to hear, or the prisoners would.
The authorities in San Eva were already sending in new prisoners, victims, really, to replace those who had escaped. There were 5 unfortunates living in the old mine at it now, and laboring under the threat of whip and chain throughout the day. As before, all of these new prisoners were Indians. None of the local Mexican population was ever sentenced to work at the mine, it seemed.
What about a night off, then? This is bothering you, Sam. I can see that it is.
I just want to get it behind us, so we can get away from here. Besides, I think I must be close. If I have any hope of finding out if Pete is down there, I think I'll do it soon. Give me 2 more nights. If I do not find him by then, we will just have to conclude that we are wrong about all this and go back to the ranch.
2 nights. Fair enough. We should be about out of supplies by then anyway, so that works out well enough. I'll take the mule back to Doc's livery and we can go out to the ranch.
Speaking of which, I am hungry enough that I could eat that mule. What do you say we go see what Willow has cooked for our breakfast?
The young Apache woman had recovered sufficiently to begin performing most of their camp tasks. She still seemed weak, but by now it was apparent that the rattlesnake's venom would have no lasting ill effects on her. The brothers made their way to their camp, which they had taken pains to hide and to improve over the last few days, to find a skillet of diced potatoes along with some sort of root and unidentifiable meat set at the side of some nearly cold coals at the fire pit.
So where is your girlfriend?
She is a married woman, not one of your ladies' fair.
Fine. She could be one of the Queen of England's ladies-in-waiting for all I care. My question was, where the heck is she?
Sam hunkered down beside the remains of their fire and felt the skillet. There was very little residual heat in the heavy cast iron.
If I had to guess, Matt, I would say Willow decided the time was right for her to go home. I think she has gone to find her husband and her people.
Without saying goodbye?
I could be wrong, but I think so. Yes.
You Indians sure aren't very demonstrative, are you?
That is one of the first things they teach us. Never let a white man know what you are thinking.
And mighty good you are at it, too.
Thank you.
But I still think she could have said goodbye.
I am just glad we were able to help. And look at the bright side, Matt.
Sam looked into the skillet and made a sour face.
With only 2 of us sharing this, whatever it is, there is more for each. Yum, yum.
Fine. Now let's eat and get some sleep before the day turns too hot for comfort.
Matt dug their utensils out and handed Sam a spoon. The 2 of them would eat out of the skillet rather than soil plates that would just have to be cleaned afterward. On the morning after the 4th night, Matt looked at Sam over breakfast.
You're cutting things awful close, aren't you? It's already too bright for comfort. The sun will be up in a few minutes. Something's wrong, isn't it?
Nothing more than what we already suspected, but yes. I found Pete's body. I was trying to work it free from the rocks, but it's awfully hard to do and remain quiet. I didn't want to alert anyone up above. He isn't very far down the slope. I was afraid someone might hear.
Tomorrow night, then. We'll have to come back tomorrow night.
There is something else, Matt.
Yes?
Something neither one of us thought of, although we should have.
Is it something we can handle?
Yes, of course, but the body, Matt, it isn't in very good shape. It is hot down there, and things decompose rather quickly. And then there are the things that live in the rocks. Mice, rats. I don't know what all is down there, but it is not a very pretty sight, Matt. It could be we should just leave him there.
No, we have to take him back. You haven't met Anita yet, but I can tell you she will want to bury Pete, even if she has to come back and find him herself.
She wouldn't do such a thing as that, surely.
I think she might once she knows for sure that he's dead. We would have to tell her that much, and how we know for sure, and that would mean telling her where Pete's body is. You know we would even if we didn't want to. It would cause no end of trouble, and there's no telling what those men might do if Anita came along and threatened to expose their secrets.
The mine is no secret.
No, but the murders are, and they've murdered more than just those Indians, bad as that is. Maybe the folks around here wouldn't say too much about some Apaches and Yaquis being killed out here. But they'd sure squawk once they know that Americans and Mexicans have been murdered by these people. I really think Anita would be in danger of her life if she came and tried to claim Pete's body. Being a woman wouldn't be enough to protect her.
But the condition of the body, you haven't seen it, brother.
Fine. So we'll do something to cope with that. We can sew him into, I don't know. Yes, by gum, I do know. I'll take the blankets out of my bedroll. We can wrap them inside the canvas and tie them up nice and tight there. We've about used up our supplies, so there isn't much of a load for the mule to carry. We can wrap Pete up and pack him out on the mule. Anita doesn't ever have to see the condition he's in.
She will insist on seeing him, if only to know in her heart that it is Pete and that he is dead.
You're probably right about that, and there won't be anything you or me can do to stop her, but we can try. After that, we can only do so much.
Tonight, we will get a good sleep today, and tonight I need you to come with me. It will take both of us to finish getting the body out of those stones and up to the road, so we can load it onto the mule. The sensible thing from there, I think, will be for us to go down this evening already prepared to leave. As soon as we have Pete's body, we can pull out and head for the ranch. With any kind of luck, we should be there by midday tomorrow.
Good enough. Now move your elbow a little. You're blocking me from getting at that skillet, brother.
The stuff tastes better than it looks, doesn't it?
The two finished their meal, tidied up the campsite, and stretched out in their bedrolls to sleep. When Matt and Sam woke up the next morning, they were facing the muzzles of four very large caliber muskets. The Mexican soldiers wore tall hats with huge brass medallions on them and shiny brims, dark blue coats with brass buttons and white canvas webbing crisscrossing their chests, with another brass medallion at the point where the stark white bands crossed. Sam always thought of those as being good aiming points. But then, what did he know about military things? He was only an Indian. Polished black leather accoutrements dangled from the webbing on the soldiers' uniforms. And, ominously enough, there were very long, very sharply pointed bayonets affixed to the muskets.
Why are these bellboys here?
Sam glanced toward Matt and gave his blood brother a half smile, then returned his attention to the Mexicans.
What can we do for you?
Levántate! Sobre sus pies!
No, habla español.
What the devil was that?
I told him we don't understand.
You did?
I think so, maybe.
You think so? Do me a favor, brother. Don't go saying any more stuff that you aren't sure of. You might could tell them to shoot us and never know you'd said it.
Do any of you speak English?
The response from the Mexicans was silence. The leader, however, did motion with his bayonet, prompting the brothers to their feet.
I'm not real sure that I like this.
Local custom. They're trying to make us feel welcome.
Sure they are.
The smile, or perhaps the conversation, did not set well with one of the soldiers. The man jabbed Matt in the belly with his bayonet.
Hey!
Sam bristled and was tempted to have at their captors. He probably would have gone for his Colt, never mind that there were four rifles cocked and aimed his way, except his gun belt was rolled and lying on the blanket where he had been sleeping until these soldiers showed up.
Back off.
Are you all right?
Bruise, maybe, but it didn't break the skin. Hurts like the very devil, though.
They have four shots, Matt. And if those bayonets haven't been sharpened...
The Mexican gestured to indicate Matt and Sam should turn around. The hand motions they understood well enough, even if the language was not shared. Reluctantly, they turned around. Rough hands grabbed hold of the brothers' arms from behind. Matt had thoughts of a military-style execution by firing squad, and he would have been willing to bet that Sam did, too. He resisted the tug on his arms as the soldier behind him tried to pull Matt's wrists behind his back. If he only had his revolver... But of course, he did not. The best he would be able to do was to whirl around and try to overcome the soldiers before they could bring those long-barreled muskets to bear. Matt's heart turned to stone. He felt as if he had been suddenly stabbed through his heart. Sam. They'd shot Sam. Matt whirled, right fist cocked, left hand groping for something or someone to fend off. He stopped, stood upright, his mouth gaped open in sheer astonishment. All four Mexicans were on the ground. Sam was standing there unharmed. And 7 Apache warriors stood over the fallen Mexicans. The soldiers looked considerably the worse for wear. Their fancy shakos with the glittering brass lay in the dust, and their rifles were now in the hands of the Apaches. One of the soldiers, the one who had been the leader, was dying. His throat had been slashed so deeply it was a wonder his head remained on his shoulders, and blood poured out of the gaping cut in his throat. The other 3 Mexicans were terrified. They had every reason to be. While Matt watched in open-mouthed astonishment, an Apache warrior took one of the soldiers' own muskets and drove the bayonet socket deep into the Mexican's chest. The soldier fell, either already dead or mercifully passed out. The Apache contemptuously tossed the rifle butt aside. The bayonet was still stuck deep in the soldier's chest so that the musket wobbled and then stood partially upright, moving very slightly with the dying man's fading breaths. The remaining 2 soldiers turned and, much too late, tried to flee. Pairs of strong hands grabbed them, bore them to the ground, held them there while cold-faced Apache warriors slashed the scalps from the still-living Mexicans. Matt guessed they were too deep in shock to make a sound. When they were done with the scalping, the Apaches stood and one of them spit on the soldier who lay at his feet, looking up at his own scalp dangling from the hand of the dark warrior. Incredibly enough, at least to Matt's way of thinking, the Apaches paid no more attention to the soldiers, not to the dead, nor to the pair who still lived, despite having their scalps taken. The Apaches turned then and gave their attention to Matt, and mostly to Sam. The leader smiled and stepped forward to greet Sam with a clasping of forearm to forearm.
"It is good, Two Wolf. I see that you are well. This is the brother you speak of?"
"Yes, this one is my brother. It is a shame he did not get my good looks, is it not?" "This is Matt. Brother, these are my friends Coronado and Ana and Tomas. These men I do not yet know. We owe each of you a debt of thanks."
Matt noticed that the Mexican with the musket planted in his chest had ceased breathing. The 2 who had been scalped lay silent. He guessed they were pretending to be dead, so they would not draw any more attention to themselves. The Apaches had not forgotten about them, however. Several of the warriors took the trembling Mexicans by the arms and dragged them away. Wherever they were being taken, and for whatever purpose, Matt was awfully glad he was not going with them. He had heard about the terrible things the Apaches did to captive enemies. A few moments later, several others came out of the brush in ghost-like silence. Women and a gaggle of children of various ages. The children divided their wide-eyed stares between the dead Mexicans and the live visitors. Sam seemed to pay no attention to the horrible sounds. He came toward Matt with the leader of the Apaches and a young, rather pretty Apache woman.
"Brother, I'd like you to meet my friend Coronado, and you already know his wife, Willow."
The children tore their attention away from the Cheyenne and American visitors and scampered away to watch the much more interesting entertainment offered by the soldiers.
"Are we having a celebration here?"
"It looks like some of us are."
Sam nodded toward the Apache women, all of whom were kneeling around a matati, their hands combining to make the work light and cheerful. The children were off to the side, playing quietly at games Matt could not begin to understand. The men, once they'd finished with the Mexicans, had gathered up their newfound wealth of muskets and disappeared into the brush on the mountain slopes.
"Willow, may we ask what you ladies are doing over there?"
"We prepare to cook, you see. Corn cakes. Soon our men will return with meat."
Matt shuddered to think just what kind of meat they might bring back should the Apache men run into another patrol of Mexican soldiers. Not that he suspected the tribe of being cannibals. They clearly were not. But all that screaming while the soldiers died so terribly and so slowly was not exactly something Matt wanted to hear at mealtime. Or any other time, for that matter.
"Do you know when they'll be back?"
The thought of food was usually enough to stir Matt's hunger. And now he had the sight of those women grinding corn to reinforce that.
"Soon."
Now that she was reunited with her husband, Willow seemed almost to have forgotten about the snake bite, although she did continue to favor that arm a little.
"What are you laughing about?"
"Nothing, really. Just realizing that soon to an Apache is probably the same as soon to a Cheyenne.
Oh.
Matt knew quite good and well that in his adopted tribe, soon could mean anything from 5 minutes to 5 weeks. It was anything but the same as the concept of soon to an American. As it turned out, they did not have terribly long to wait. Within an hour, the Apache warriors materialized out of the scrub with the same ghost-like silence with which they left. They were carrying poles from which dangled a fat doe and a half-grown fawn. No gunshots had been heard, so the deer may well have been harvested far from camp. It was also possible that a trick in the shape of gullies and washes on the mountainside had contained the sounds or directed the noise elsewhere. The important thing was that if the shots were not heard at the camp, it was most unlikely that they had been heard down below at the mine, where Case Wilhelm and his men were. The deer were quickly skinned and the fawn plastered with mud, then buried on top of a bed of coals with more glowing coals added on top of it. The meat would take hours to cook, but when it was done, it would be moist and tender. A layer of loose dirt was spread over the buried meat, and a hot, smokeless fire was quickly built on top of that. The dough was cut into strips that were piled on a broad, tightly woven tray. First the men, then the women, and finally the children would be allowed to select whatever strips they pleased and hold them over the fire on long sticks. Coronado waved his hand.
Come, eat now.
Coronado provided each guest with a long stick and gave them the honor of choosing the first strips of dark red meat. After those, however, it would be every man for himself. Sam did not show anything in his expression, but he found it amusing that this camp where he and Matt had been for the past several days was now inexplicably the property of Coronado's band of Apaches. Not that it mattered, of course. The earth is the property of the Great Spirit and not any individual human. In his heart, Sam still held many of the beliefs of his Cheyenne people. He had been given a good education by his mother, by Matt's family, and later on when he attended the white men's schools, and he considered himself a good Christian. But he still equated God with the Great Spirit he had known since infancy. It was something he had long since accepted and no longer bothered trying to rationalize.
Do you have whiskey?
No, sorry.
No matter. We will use these guns. Go steal some.
Where will you do this?
Coronado pointed down at the mine from which he and Sam had so recently escaped.
There. Those men are bad. They should die. They have whiskey. I smell it on the stink of their breath each morning.
You will kill them?
Of course.
Would you mind telling us when you will do this thing?
Why you want to know this?
Because my brother and I have something we must do down on that slope below the Arashtra. It will cause noise, perhaps much noise. If we do what we must do when you and your warriors are raiding the white man's place, it will be of help to us. They will be too busy with you to think about any sound we make.
Ah, bueno.
What?
Good means good. It is well.
Yes, my friend, it is good. Whenever you and your warriors are ready, we will all go down together, and each will do those things that must be done.
Later, their bellies full to groaning with broiled venison and rough-ground corn cakes, Matt leaned close to Sam.
You're mighty careful to avoid telling Coronado just what it is we have to do down there. How come?
Because, my ignorant brother, with most tribes it is taboo, a truly terrible thing, to have anything to do with the dead. I do not know about the Apaches in particular, but most tribes would be scandalized by the idea of digging up a body and hauling it off. They could be so upset as to refuse to help us. They might even try to stop us. It's better, I think, to say nothing on the subject.
All right. In that case, I can mind my mouth for the next few hours. Say now, with that out of the way, I think I can hold one more strip of that good meat.
There was still a fair amount left, even after the children were allowed at it.
Matt, if you bust wide open, don't look for me to help you.
It's a chance I'm willing to take, brother.